My name is Lisa DeLay, and you are listening to the Spark My Muse podcast. Today, my guest is author of 18 international bestsellers. You might be familiar with his books, Lynchpin, Tribes, The Dip, and Purple Cow. They've been translated into 35 languages. He's spoken to millions of people at public events at companies such as Cadillac, eBay, Google, Disney, Amazon, Microsoft, Adobe, American Eagle, Eddie Bauer, and hundreds of others. He's twice spoken at the TED.com conference, and he is consistently ranked in the top 1% of all speakers at events he attends. He's joining me today to talk about his new podcast, about taking your turn, about fear, and ruining sourdough bread. I'm very excited to welcome Seth Godin to the podcast today. It was just such a joy to hear you at the gathering, and I really appreciated that you would walk around amongst us and sit down and just chat with us like a regular mortal. It was really fun to hear your wisdom and to actually just have the whole gathering was so interesting, everybody kind of conversing and enjoying it together.
Yeah, well, I mean, I am us. We are us. Mm-hmm. Why go to an event if you're not going to hang out with people? That's my take.
Yeah. What did you enjoy the most when you were there?
I ran into some old friends who I didn't expect. That was thrilling. And mostly it was the vibe. It was people coming together not to hustle anybody, not to find some short-term win, not to make a point, but to actually truly connect. That's too rare, and it was thrilling.
Yeah, I agree. I made so many friends, and it was just fun to sit down at a table and to say, you know, where'd you come from and what are you interested in? And it was as if you were having the fourth conversation with them instead of the first one.
Exactly.
And everybody was wide open to just the same spirit, being on the same page. And it was really such a pleasure. So, and there weren't any duds. Like, there weren't any speakers that you were like, I wish I'd done something else. So, I started following you about the time that your book Tribes came out, and I studied communication design, which is kind of like graphic design and advertising in college in my undergrad. And so I was really interested, and you were a longtime.com guy and online way before people were even noticing it, I think. So I was really interested in some of the things you were talking about in permission marketing and following you since that point on your blog and everything. And I was wondering, I think you've been on Typepad for maybe 16 years, but how long have you been consistently posting every day?
Someone sent me a note about a post that, and I searched for it, and I realized it was 11 years old, and I looked at some of the other posts from 11 years ago, and I was posting three times a day in 2006. And they weren't just like, I had tofu for breakfast kind of posts. They were some of the best posts I've ever done, three a day.
Oh, wow.
So I can't tell you when I switched to one a day, but I can tell you that my email newsletter began in 1991.
Wow. Right, before there was, when it was just email.
Yeah.
Things were just email. And then when, about what time did you switch to something online? Because nobody was even really going online for a while.
Yeah, including me. I missed that whole window, which was embarrassing. I had a blog before I was on Typepad, but I can't find it. I don't remember anything about it. And I went to a conference a bunch of years ago, and I don't think it was 16, but it was close. And at the table with me were Jacqueline Novogratz, who runs the Acumen Fund. I had never met her before. Stephen Breyer, who said, I'm a judge. I had never met him before. Sergey Brin, who said he ran a small search engine. I had never met him before. And a guy named Joey Ito, who now runs the Media Lab. And at the time, he was on the board of Six Apart Typepad. And I looked at what he was doing on his screen. I said, that's what I want my blog to look like. And I started on Typepad that day.
Wow. And Typepad's nice and simple without any like hoopla and bells and whistles and everything. And you've just stayed like that. But I noticed, you know, when you have a thing on your Typepad, if you click your head, you get kind of like, oh, here's some stuff that's more like a website, and you can kind of click into there and see all the different stuff you're doing, including your Alt-MBA, which I hope we can talk a little bit about that. And then this big surprise, which I've been like, why didn't Seth do this? I can't wait to ask you a little bit more, is Akimbo, your podcast, all of a sudden comes along. And I'm sure people have been saying, Seth, why don't you podcast? And I have to ask, why now?
The podcast thing has been a challenge for me. I did a very early podcast 7 years ago that is still one of the top 100 business podcasts in the world. And I recorded the whole thing in one weekend. It wasn't really a podcast. It was a recording of a two-day event that got broken into 14 pieces. And then I was done with it. I have resisted having my own podcast because of our friend Krista Tippett. And the reason is that I listened to Krista every week for 10 years before I met her. And she's now a dear friend. But it took months for me to unlearn who I thought she was because of the audio intimacy of being a podcast host. That when you're in someone's headphones, it's different than when you're writing or even when you're on stage. And I hesitated to go into someone's headphones because once you do, you can't go back. And so I stalled. I knew exactly what podcast I wanted to make. I thought I had something to contribute, but I was stalling. And then the people who distributed my first podcast called me up and they said, look, it's still popular, but why don't you make another one? And I said to myself, well, either I got to stop whining about the podcast thing or I got to make it. So I made it.
And what it seems like, maybe you can correct me or guide me into closer to the truth, but what it seems like so far, you've just done a few episodes. It seems a lot like the blog, but it just seems more fleshed out. Is that the direction you see it going in?
Yeah. Well, when I sat down to make a podcast, I said, I can't make a better podcast than the traditional style podcast. I'm not an interviewer. And I mean, I do it under duress, but it's not my natural state. And I like to innovate in media. So what would be the rules that I would break? So Akimbo is only 20 minutes long. It doesn't have any interviews. I'm the only guest. It doesn't have me reading the ads because I think the future clearly is like that. And I wanted to basically do what you said, which is take something that's a little longer than a blog post, flesh it out, try to help people see something they didn't see before. And ideally, every once in a while, make one that people will listen to 4 times or 5 times or 10 times because audio is magical. And if I can get under your skin and my voice resonates, then I will repay Zig Ziglar and Pema Chodron and Krista Tippett and Brian Koppelman and the people who came before me because they gave me this great gift and I'd like to give it to others.
Yeah, very good. That's the thing about your blog. You've probably heard this a bunch of times, but for the few people that are going to be out there, I know there's some people who don't know who you are, who listen to this show. When I said to a few people that I was going to be interviewing you, because I'm keeping this a surprise, some people were like, wow, that's great. And some people were like, who? Seth?
Perfect.
Seth Rogen? No, I'm not Seth. No, absolutely not. He's never going to come on my show. But I said, you know, some people read his blog posts like a spiritual practice. It's like how they get going in the morning or how they reflect on something during the day that's going to kind of stick with them and they can mull over because it's usually something that'll kind of flip things in your mind or push against something and in a really challenging way. And I think that's really powerful, that kind of thing that's something that I hope to do in some of my solo episodes. Every other week I try to get somewhere and ask questions about the person's interior world who's listening, maybe challenge them to make a new friendship they wouldn't think of or something like that. But that's the thing that little poignant thing that is so delicious about the blog that you're going to be doing with audio now is really exciting. And it does reach kind of a whole new group of people who maybe listen in their car, but they don't get online very much.
Well, Thank you. That was very nice of you to say. Let me explain why I said it was terrific when people don't know who I am. I am not looking to have more listeners or more readers. Mm. I have enough. And deciding that was a transformational moment in my life. Because as soon as you can start making writing for your readers, as opposed to looking for readers for your writing, your work changes. And your narrative about your work changes. So my goal is not to say, how do I dumb it down? How do I put a BuzzFeed type headline in? How do I promote it? How do I hype it? How do I get more and more and more? It's how do I honor the people who trust me? And it's just, you know, some of the people that I think you and I follow, like Pema Chodron or Krista, that's the approach that they take. And it permits us to make great work. You know, Richard Serra, who's a transformational sculptor, his sculptures weigh up to 2 million pounds, is disliked or ignored by the vast majority of the people in the world. Right? If he's lucky, he's ignored by them. A few, he's disliked. And then there are a few people, among them museum curators and some museum visitors, who gasp when they see his work in the most positive way. So what Richard Serra could have done is chosen to make smaller, easier to absorb, less difficult sculptures. But then he wouldn't be Richard Serra. And our society, our culture pushes us to fit in, to do what we're told, and also sort of buy into the promise that if we do those things, we'll get to be famous. And number one, being famous isn't that good. And number two is being famous for someone who isn't you is a fraud. And that's why, you know, it wasn't easy to be Bob Denver. He wasn't Gilligan, but he was famous and sort of beloved for being Gilligan. And what did that get him? You can do better than that. You don't have to be Gilligan.
Yeah, and you're quite famous, but you're also very much yourself. You're, you know, the Purple Cow, when it came out, was of course very memorable because it's called Purple Cow, and the idea is very salient and potent. And I think once you explain it, it's really easy to explain and understand. And yet there's all this pressure, like you're saying, you know, get the clickbait going. How do you get more followers? How do you you know, even do something infamous to get popular? And there's such a drive for that, even among the young. Like I have a teenage daughter, and there's, you know, how many Instagram followers do you have? It's even among people who aren't trying to start a business. They're just trying to have, feel good about themselves or have friendships. There's such a social pressure, at least in the United States, to make sure that people notice you and that you're seen, that I think people doing really good, important work or making important things or trying to do something good in the world will feel very discouraged about not being noticed.
Right. But if they take just a second to look at who they aspire to be like and who has influenced them, you know, those people, just go look at the reviews for To Kill a Mockingbird. There are hundreds of negative reviews of that book. Mm. How could that be? Well, it's because it's not for everyone, even a beloved book like that. That if you think about great musicians, whether they're jazz musicians or rock musicians or rap musicians, they weren't popular at the beginning. Some of them were never popular. And this decision to be the Monkees versus to be Bob Dylan is transformative. That the Monkees were huge and watched on TV and adored by teenagers, but nobody's missing the Monkees right now.
That's true.
And what we have to do is accept the fact that what comes with being a meaningful specific, as opposed to a wandering generality, as Zig Ziglar would say, is the responsibility. That you can't say, well, I'm doing this because everybody else is doing it, which, you know, that might be why your daughter wants to wear a certain thing or do a certain thing in high school, because there's huge pressure in high school to do what everybody else is doing. Mm-hmm. But if you don't do what everyone else is doing, then it's on you. You're not following the crowd, you're leading. And that's a big responsibility. And most people from an early age are trained to avoid that responsibility. And a key part of what I'm trying to teach people is to be able to say, here, I made this. And that's at the heart of the Alt MBA, which is the project I'm working the most on right now, which is teaching people in 30 days in a seminar online how to see the world differently, how to make things, how to take responsibility for one's work, and how to do it with more flair and passion and speed than you ever thought possible. And we've run it 18 times and it works.
Wow.
And the hardest part of it is getting people to believe that it's possible, that it's possible for them to put on a new set of glasses and make a bigger impact.
Now, with the Alt MBA, it looks like you run it twice a year. It's just a month and it looks really concentrated and also relies on collaboration. Do you think you could flesh that out a little bit? What does it look like?
We run it 4 times a year in a group of 125 to 150 people.
Oh, okay.
The group has live coaches around the world. So far, we have students from 46 countries, I think. Mm. And all our coaches are alumni. There's no video. I'm not in it. I'm not in it live. I'm not in it recorded. It's mm-hmm. a series of projects, 13 or 14 projects, one every couple of days, with group work, with publishing that work, with getting feedback on your work, with giving feedback on the work. You will give more feedback and get more feedback in a month than you will have gotten in the previous 2 years. And that cycle of ship it, talk about it, publish it, get feedback, respond to the feedback, ship it again, over and over again, for 30 days, what you discover by the end is that you'd been strolling around and you were capable of sprinting.
Mm. And also doesn't give you any time for fear?
Yeah, I don't think fear goes away, but what it does is it doesn't let the fear expand to control you. That the fear is actually a compass, that if I'm doing my best work, I'm afraid. And if I'm not feeling that fear, it means I'm hiding.
Now, today you wrote on your blog about ruining a batch of sourdough. And I was wondering if you could expound a little on that for anybody who hasn't read that blog post today.
I've been a baker for a long time. I knew the great Lionel Poulain in Paris before his tragic death. He was the greatest baker ever. His bakery was in the basement of a former monastery on Rue de Cherche Midi in Paris. And the walls were filled with ancient microbes that had been around for hundreds of years associated with the making of bread. And when he scaled up the business, what he did not do was listen to anybody who understood how to industrialize anything. What he did instead was build a giant circle of ovens, a dozen of them, with one baker per oven and the dough in the center of the room, keeping the individual nature of what he was trying to do. And the big lesson that I learned from him is the bread isn't ready because you need it to be ready. The bread is ready because it's ready. And it needs to ferment and it needs to sit. And you can't do it faster. And you can't turn up the heat in the oven and hope that a hotter oven cooks bread just as well, but faster. It's just not the way it works. And so, yes, this weekend, I forgot everything he taught me. And I rushed everything and I ended up with a brick. And the other half of the lesson, though, is not just that low and slow is the only way to do this. But the other half is this. Most of the time, we tell ourselves we're letting it ferment. We tell ourselves we're going low and slow. But what we're actually doing is hiding. That you don't need more time. You just need to decide. That you don't need to wait a year to launch this or 6 months to launch that. You can bring it to the world today. And the reason that you're hesitating might be because you understand the fermentation process. But it's probably because you're afraid.
And do we give ourselves any hints to tip ourselves off of that? Does it require a lot of introspection to know that we're afraid?
Well, the only way a baker can with authority tell you that you can't rush the bread is by trying to rush the bread. Mm. And so now I know what the rye bread is capable of. If you're sitting there saying, my first novel will be ready in 18 months, I would challenge you and say, how do you know? Mm-hmm. When was the last time you published a short story? When was the last time you published the first draft of the novel just to see what would happen? That with Medium and with blog posts and with self-publishing, there is nobody you need permission from to bring your work to the world. I'm betting that this extraordinarily generous podcast that you do, which is now up to episode 120-something, which is extraordinary, wasn't ready when you shipped the first one. How could it be? How could it possibly be ready? You didn't know if it was going to work. And when Gutenberg launched the printing press, 94% of the people in Europe didn't know how to read. So it was a really stupid time to invent the book. And when Carl Benz launched the car, it was against the law to drive in Germany. He should have waited until there were roads and gas stations and everything else. Because how are you going to sell cars if there are no gas stations? You should wait. But the thing is, if you wait, there will never be gas stations.
And so, yeah, we'll make up excuses and postpone and not get into it because there'll always be some reason to not do it. That's good. I know a lot of writing friends that listen to the show and that I correspond with, and there is a lot of fear in writing because it's something that's often done in solitary confinement, in isolation, and writers can be, can feel alone and bad about their work and stuff, and they need to do things sort of solitary, but at the same time have kind of a community. And is that something that you have found helpful for your work, or how do you tend to work on your own or with like a group of people helping you?
Every writer I've ever met feels alone, feels bad about their work, every single one. The difference between a professional successful writer and a tortured writer is that a professional successful writer publishes her work. And no one gets plumber's block. The thing is, writer's block is invented. It's made up. And commiserating with other writers doesn't make writer's block better. It makes writer's block worse. Real true professional writers write. They sit down and they write. So Neil Gaiman famously said that when he's feeling behind, what he does is he surrounds himself with nothing. Because if he gets bored enough, the only way to entertain himself is to write. My friend Isaac Asimov, who died a bunch of years ago, published 400 books in his lifetime. 400. And wow. He did that by sitting down at a typewriter at 6:30 every morning, 6 days a week, and typing until noon. And the deal was really simple. Type anything you want. It doesn't have to be good, but type. And if you do that deal, your subconscious says, oh, well, I might as well type something good because I don't want to be embarrassed by typing something bad because I got to type something. And that's why I think everyone should have a blog, a daily blog, because when you go to bed the night before, your subconscious is saying, I got to write something tomorrow. And that's a gift. What a gift to have your subconscious working for you as opposed to working against you. Because it's more embarrassing to miss a day of posting than it is to post something mediocre. So you post. And if you're going to post anyway, it'll probably be good.
Yeah, we don't really have thinker's block. I think we're thinking about something even if we're worried thoughts, we're still thinking. And so it seems like something should come out. Something of some kind should come out. But as we're talking to people, even if we're talking about writer's block, sometimes there's a safety in just complaining and not doing the thing.
Exactly. What could be better? It's almost perfect. You get all the credit for being a writer and none of the penalties for being mediocre.
I know what helps me is deadlines, even if they're deadlines that I just put on myself. And that helps to kind of light a fire under me, even though just the pressure helps, I think. So otherwise, I might just, I don't know. It's not, I guess it's a kind of fear and laziness perhaps, but I know that the momentum helps me continue to generate. And being very disciplined about this podcast, doing it every single week, you know, coming into my fourth year. And I know some people get a little tired. They'll go, oh, we'll do some seasons. And for me, it's just, I'm going to consistently do this because I can. and I enjoy it. So it's going to happen. And I'm not going to run out of ideas because I don't run out of thoughts. So
exactly. And when you get to year 12, you're going to be an overnight success.
Yeah, maybe. And I think that's part of loving what you do. If you're not going to love it in 12 years, then you can do something else that you actually love.
Well, let me challenge you on that for just a second.
Okay.
I don't think I was born to be a writer. Mm-hmm. I know that in my high school yearbook, my English teacher wrote that I was the bane of her existence and I would never amount to anything.
Oh, man.
And in college, I took exactly one English class. Mm. I think that I like writing because people like reading my stuff, even when it's only four people, not because I like touching the keyboard. Mm-hmm. And so the practice of committing to something for 12 years, if you can just merely and simply like the practice, then you have the freedom to find a practice that will repay your effort. And it doesn't matter. You know, I know some poets, and poets like to roll their eyes at the fact that it's very hard to be a professional poet, and that it's very difficult to be recognized and to develop an audience as a poet. Well, then they shouldn't be a poet. They should do something else that will give them the satisfaction with words that they get, because there's nothing about, you know, hexagonal pentameter that is giving them joy. It's the craft. Mm. And so my friend Sarah Kay, I published her book a few years ago as a best-selling new book of poetry of the year. Sarah Kay can get up on stage and do spoken word poetry and change the lives of 3 million people. And real, unquote, poets roll their eyes at this. This isn't real poetry because it's not in some dusty poetry journal somewhere. Well, but I would say to them, why are you doing this thing? Are you doing this thing so you can whine about it? Or are you doing this thing so you can change people? Because if changing people with words is your goal, then find a way to do it. You've done it with a podcast. Sarah Kay does it with spoken word poetry. I do it with blogs. Find something that where you can do it and do it and do it, and where the medium will repay you for your effort.
I was watching something that you had been in a video with Maria Forleo, and you were talking about how you think calling is a myth.
Right.
And it, just for kind of what you're saying here, that you can find something that you enjoy doing, and it can find a different instrument, I guess you could say, find a different method to come out, just as long as it's a good fit for you. And I think that's a really fascinating thing to tell young people, or even people who are just frustrated. I haven't found my calling. I don't know what I'm here to do. Do you think you could unpack that a little bit?
Sure. I mean, Marie asked me the question. It's been asked a bunch of times of, you know, how does someone find their calling? And I think that's fear talking. I don't think there's such a thing as having a calling. That my guess is that Yo-Yo Ma's favorite thing in the world is not playing the cello. He is a professional cello player, but that doesn't mean it's his hobby. And Liz Gilbert talks about the difference between a vocation and an avocation. And everyone should have avocations, hobbies, things that light their fire for non-commercial, non-professional reasons. But you should also have a vocation. And a vocation is something that you can approach as a professional where you can find joy in the craft. And what I know is that there are people who work at 7-Eleven who find joy in the craft of serving 600 cups of coffee every morning, knowing people by name, engaging with them, being the one person who smiled at them who would miss that customer if they didn't show up tomorrow. That is a craft. It is a craft as much as it is a craft to be a writer. That I met a woman who lives in Kibera, which is the biggest slum in Kenya, right in the center. And she built a medical clinic. She's trained as a nurse, and she saved the lives of 10 or 20,000 people a year. Now, is that her calling? Well, I don't know. I think if she had not been born in Kibera, she probably wouldn't have opened a medical clinic in Kibera. But given where she is and who she is, she found a way to make a difference. But I think you make a difference first and then decide it's your calling, not the other way around.
And I also want to thank you for being so generous to me. You have you've reached out when I lost my water bottle and you mailed it to me. That was very kind of you.
Did it arrive?
It sure did, right the next day. Thank you so much. And generosity isn't just something that you talk about doing. You walk the talk and you also, you give a lot of yourself and you give things away. But generosity is something that sometimes people don't understand. They'll think there'll be strings attached or something. They'll be like, I'm going to give this hoping that it's a seed I'm planting that I'll get some harvest and that something will come back to me.
That's a great point. Yes.
Yeah, I would love it if you could talk a little bit more about that with people who are hoping to do a project to create something, but they do want something back there. What's the difference between giving something out and being generous?
So the key word here is reciprocity. Mm. Most human beings by culture and genetics are wired to reciprocate. So someone opens a door for you, you will rush ahead to open a door for them, even though they're a stranger. Even Stephen, we want to reciprocate. And marketers and salespeople and hustlers have used that against us for a very long time. Mm. You know, you'll see those people who pretend to be monks on the streets of New York who will hand you a medal and then get very angry when you don't respond with a donation. Mm. Reciprocity for me is a short-term hype play. It's nothing I'm interested in. The alternative are gifts. And Lewis Hyde wrote an extraordinary book called The Gift that I recommend to everybody. And in it, he delineates the difference between status games, reciprocity, and true gifts. So here's an example. In the Bible, it says you shouldn't charge interest. But what it really says is you shouldn't charge interest to anyone in the tribe. And the reason is that you would never charge your sister interest on a loan because it's family. But if you do charge interest, it pushes you away from the person. It becomes a transaction. Mm. And it's okay to transact with strangers. It's okay to transact with people outside the tribe. But the idea is that people inside the tribe, you give them a gift. And maybe they'll repay you, maybe they won't. That's not part of the deal. And this act of paying it into the community has a vague repayment. And the repayment is that if we pay it into our community, we get to live in a better community. That's sufficient. And what I discovered, what I learned from my parents, is that it's almost impossible to overdo it. That if you can make your community a better place for you and your family, it's very rare that you will regret that. And it's not because it's a matter of survival or profit. It's because as humans, when we live in a better community, everyone's life is better.
That's really interesting. A lot of people will, including myself, will kind of count the cost. Like, well, how much giving is too much? And, you know, what I loved, I don't know if you were there for David White, when the poet at the gathering, when he was talking about half forgetting yourself when you give.
Right.
I really liked that word picture because that's when you're actually maybe able to give out of a different kind of thought process, or maybe less of a thought process, where you're just giving, I don't even know if it's for the greater good, but you're giving more open-handedly without thinking, without getting stingy.
Every time I hear David White speak, I want to repeat myself. I can't stop it. It just gets started and it'll go on for days. It's terrible. He has certainly trademarked that approach. But the way he talked about it was beautiful. I would look at it this way. You sell something for a living. There's a thing you do professionally. I don't think you should give that away. I don't think it is generous to give that away. I think it is a form of fear to give that away. But there are many other things that we can give away that are generative, that we don't run out of. And that abundance thinking as opposed to scarcity thinking is the key. So in my case, if you want me to get on a plane and come give a speech and your name isn't Krista Tippett, you have to pay me to do it. I don't give that away.
Mm.
But if you want to read my blog post, it's free. And there are no ads on my blog. It's just free. Here, I made this. Mm-hmm. I want to spread it. It doesn't cost me anything if more people read it. And it doesn't cost me anything if I dig deeper and write a more generous post. And that's the distinction, is that we say, what can I do here that involves emotional labor, that involves showing up with my full self to see somebody else for who they are, even though I'm afraid? That's a generous act. But giving away all your furniture doesn't scale, because you're going to run out of furniture. And it turns out that we do have a society where there are people who don't have enough food, where there are people who don't have clean water. And I am a huge fan of philanthropy, mm-hmm. because it makes both sides better. Mm-hmm. But it's even more important that we figure out how to build connection, that when two people trade, when they engage, when they see one another, both people benefit and a problem gets solved. So from the commercial world, a simple example is we do no longer have a coffee shortage in the United States, because Howard Schultz and others figured out how to have exchanges occur so that everywhere you go, there's a place to get an espresso. And that same thinking is used by Acumen to bring electricity and water and healthcare to people around the world who never had it before. Because if they're paying for it, even for a dollar, they're the customer, not the recipient of pity. And that journey was difficult. It wasn't like there was a long line of people in Bareilly, India, waiting to pay for clean water. It took paying it forward and investing in the community and creating justice so that there would be a platform so you could get to the next level.
Hmm.
But my rant, and it's getting complicated, but I'll try to simplify it. My rant is there are these sort of Ayn Randian, Atlas Shrugged, selfish mindsets that say everyone should just solve their problems the way I did. But the truth is no one solved their own problem. That maybe you were lucky enough to win the birthday lottery and the parent lottery and the century lottery and were born in the right place at the right time and you were on third base and claiming victory for a home run. But all of us benefited from somebody opening a door previously. And more doors we can open in this connected digital world, the better our culture gets. And the better our culture gets, the more doors there are to open. And it feels like a cycle to me.
Mm-hmm. There's something to be said, too, for as you give generously, like you're saying, into your community or neighborhood without thinking, with that self-forgetting, it's just building a lot of ground for trust. That's something that is... you can't buy it. You're just, it's too suspicious. If you're buying trust, it's pretty easy to see through it. Although you can, I suppose, trick people, but it's something that you grow over the long term and people know your actions will speak for themselves. But it's kind of, I think you're building integrity over the long term. You're putting things in the bank in a sense.
Well, do you know why that spam, the one, my brother, the king of whatever, was abducted. Do you know why that spam has so many typos and misconjugated words in it? Because you can read it and instantly tell that it's scammy. And the reason is because if smart people responded, they would waste a whole bunch of time and not be able to rip you off at the end. So it is intentionally designed to get only dumb people, gullible people, to write back. It's actually not that difficult to scam a portion of the population into trusting you. But if you do, what you will be left with is the fact that you are trusted by people who are easy to scam. And the alternative is to decide to be trusted by people who are hard to scam. Mm-hmm. And that is a longer-term plan that pays huge dividends, because what you end up is serving a group of people you would like to serve, as opposed to serving a group of people you've assembled just so you could rip them off.
Mm-hmm. Oh, this will be the last question. I don't want to take up too much of your time. Your last book is about that it's always your turn. And I would like to point people in the direction of that book, if you could give a little bit of a summary of what you're up to with it.
Yeah, so I wrote it a couple of years ago. I self-published it. I basically anointed and appointed my readers as the distribution method. Mm-hmm. So we structured it so that you could buy a bunch of copies really cheap. It's four color. I designed it myself. It's heavily illustrated. It basically is a glimpse inside my head. Mm-hmm. And it's called What to Do When It's Your Turn. And it's always your turn. And you can find it at yourturn.link. And the thesis of the book is, we're in the middle of a revolution. I don't know how long the doors are going to be open, but right now, for the first time in the history of the planet, you are one click away from more than a billion people. And that means that you have an opportunity to take your turn. We're handing you a microphone. We're handing you a keyboard. We're handing you a connection machine. And I don't think you should waste it by watching cat videos. And I am in a hurry to provoke people into the simple sentence of, here, I made this, understanding deep down that it might not work. And if you can embrace those two poles at the same time, I'm doing something that might not work, but I made this, mm-hmm. full responsibility, then maybe you can make things better.
The whole thing about being okay with failure and moving on to the next thing is something people have to be okay with in this time of that you can fail quickly, learn, move on to the next thing. I guess there's something that people can see from your life too, because they might see, oh, Seth, he's just made it big. He's been an overnight success, but you've done all sorts of things that some have done very well, some have not done very well. And for those people who are, you know, have just failed and they're not sure what to do next, what would you tell them from your experience of failure?
Well, it's pretty clear I failed more than you have. I am comfortable saying that to almost every person I've ever met. I wrote a blog post on my birthday a few years ago called 30 Years of Projects. And I listed one project per year for 30 years. And I got many more that I didn't list. And most of them failed. And most of them you don't remember. And I've written 7,400 blog posts, and more than half of them were below average. So you show up and you show up and you show up, and maybe 50 years later, someone will come to your funeral, but that's not why you're doing it. You're doing it because you have a chance to turn on a light for somebody. And the only way you can do that is by doing things that might not work.
This has been wonderful. Thank you so much, Seth, for sharing your time and your wisdom and for your body of work that has been an incredible inspiration and insight for so many people. Thank you so much.
Well, I want to thank you. I know it can be quiet and silent and lonely to make a podcast as you do, but you are gifted and talented, and it's really generous. It was a pleasure to talk to you today.
If you've listened to the show and you've thought, wow, I wish I could find out a little bit more about someone mentioned or a book or a website, that's what show notes are for. I've created an all-access pass, and you can access the access pass for just $1. It unlocks all show note episodes, too. It's a reoccurring $1 a month, and you can cancel at any time. Just go to patreon.com/sparkmymuse. Patreon is like patron with an E. patreon.com/sparkmymuse. Remember to subscribe to the show on iTunes or your podcast app, and I invite you to sign up for my newsletter at sparkmymuse.com. I try to send out a message once or twice a month. If you enjoyed the show, please rate it on iTunes. Thank you so much for listening.